powered through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by the Pro Club. Jake Heaps, Stacy Ross here. We're going to be talking with Seattle Kraken play-by-play guy John Forslund for Root Sports. That's coming up in about 30 minutes. Do not go anywhere. Before we do any of that, we're going to talk about where the Seahawks offensive coordinator search is going, and it is still going. There's a couple guys that have been eliminated. We already said that Shane Steichen, who'd been linked to the Seahawks, has taken a job elsewhere. Anthony Lynn has taken a job elsewhere. Most recently, Joe Lombardi, who had also been linked to the Seahawks, has taken a job elsewhere. So, Jake, there are only a few guys left, but there are a few guys in particular you think would be the best fit for Seattle and you think they should narrow their focus to.
Yeah, I really do think that it's become apparent as to where this is going in terms of the conversations that have happened. And if you look at just the simple fact of why this has transpired and why did it take so long, we had Mike Salk on earlier and explaining to Salk that, in my opinion, you look at two of the quarterback coaches that are a part of the Buffalo Bills and the Green Bay Packers that you look at and say, I want to wait around until these guys are available. And that was Ken Dorsey and Luke Getsy from the Green Bay Packers. And I think that's pretty obvious at this point that those are the two names that you could theoretically interview. Now, Ken Dorsey is confirmed and that is out there. Luke Getsy is not. But to me, that's a pretty easy conclusion to jump to. If you can't get Nathaniel Hackett, who is the current OC for the Green Bay Packers, the next best guy is Luke Getsy, who is the passing game coordinator and quarterbacks coach of the Green Bay Packers. And he has had a long history with the Green Bay Packers over the years and then spent some time with Mississippi State being the offensive coordinator there for a season before coming back up to Green Bay to join LaFleur. So he has a lot of background with Aaron Rodgers and what helped make them successful and being the bridge gap there between Aaron Rodgers and Matt LaFleur, which is an extremely difficult job to be in, Stacey. I mean, you imagine how difficult it is to work with Aaron Rodgers and to have the trust of Aaron Rodgers and for him to not turn on you. I mean, you've got to be a guy who knows your stuff and really can have command of a room and can be somebody that you can trust and confide in, all those things, and also be somebody that is well-respected and innovative enough for Matt LaFleur to want on his staff. The other aspect of Luke Getsy is if you're Pete Carroll and you look at it from his perspective and you see what the Green Bay Packers did this season, they were balanced, they had a great running game, and they also were able to be explosive in their play-action pass game, find ways to get Davante Adams the ball, I could easily see how you would want to pluck somebody from that tree and to try and implement that style of offense into what you have here in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we've said from the beginning that those are the two, if you were going to compare any offense to the Seattle Seahawks in terms of what their capabilities are, I believe the Green Bay Packers are a very close version of what they could be. The other guys that you look at, Ken Dorsey, and I put out on a poll, who would you pick on Twitter, JT Heaps 9, who would you pick to be the next Seahawks offensive coordinator? And I'm shocked. Almost 60% said Ken Dorsey from Buffalo. And I would love to know why. I'd love to know why.
He's a quarterbacks guy, probably.
Well,
and because Buffalo was pass heavy and they went far.
They were.
He's
yeah.
a college star at Miami.
That's also very important to know.
Very, very big college star, no doubt. In his time as a coach, though, he's only been a quarterbacks coach. He was a quarterbacks coach for the Carolina Panthers, and he was a quarterbacks coach for the Buffalo Bills. So you wonder how much he is involved in the game planning, and I'm sure he was greatly involved in the game planning. But guys like Getsy and Shane Waldron have had different experiences coaching different positions. They've been coordinators in title before. It's very interesting to me that people are very drawn to Ken Dorsey when he's just been a quarterback coach. So I wonder if that is what the thought process is there is, hey, he was a part of the Buffalo Bills turnaround for Josh Allen and would love to see that happen for Russell Wilson in this offense. And with Dorsey, that's really all I have to go on in terms of reputation and where he has been. With Shane Waldron, to me, he's the guy that intrigues me the most just simply because of the background that he has. And he's been with New England, he has coached at the college level, and then he's been with the Shanahan tree and Sean McVay for the past five seasons. And he has coached every single position that you could ever have on the offensive side of the ball.
Important to note, a former long snapper.
Waldron, former long snapper? I didn't know that about him.
That's what his Wikipedia says.
Okay. All right. Former long snapper, too. I mean, you got much love to long snappers. Now, with Shane Waldron, to me, as you look at his experience with the Rams, he's been very much involved with Sean McVay and the brain trust that is there in terms of coming up with different varieties of ways to run tempo, to have a ground game that can center your offense and have an explosive pass offense around that. So he greatly intrigues me as a guy that I think would be a great fit, that brings something different, brings a different element to this offense that you have not seen before here in Seattle. You have not seen an offense that is truly tempo-oriented, that does have the ability to be complex and have the illusion of complexity. We've heard Sean McVay and his offense be described in that way, that they are able to make easy things seem complex because of the way they set up their plays and the way that they're able to keep things connected from the run game to the play action game, to their drop back game, to their screen game. They do an excellent job of that. So if you're asking me today, Stacey, who I would love to see as a coordinator,
yeah,
to me it would be between Shane Waldron and Luke Getsy, with me leaning towards Shane Waldron.
Oh, man. Now, if you have Waldron here, are there pieces to your offense personnel-wise that would make, I don't want to say make his job easier, but what does an offense geared by him and Carroll look like? What pieces do they still need? Because Carroll would tell you, oh, we got to get either a running back or two in, either a running back by committee approach, or we've got to get our guy to replace Carson should he leave. Also got to figure out what to do on the offensive line. Is Waldron someone that's going to back up that kind of personnel acquisition? Not that it's his choice, but is that going to make his best offense?
Yeah, I believe he, with those additions, it absolutely fits into what he wants to do. And I think that, as I said before, this Rams running attack is centered around the running game. I mean, their attack is all about being balanced. And I know that they've been mostly known for being this, you know, explosive pass-heavy offense, especially when Sean McVay first became a head coach with the Rams the first couple seasons, but that is where everything starts. And I believe that that speaks to Pete Carroll's language. And I do believe that there is a way or a philosophy of, when I watch the Rams and the way that they approach games, I love the fact that they are creative in the way that they get their screen game going. I love the fact that, you know, when things are going hard, if you watch Jared Goff and their offense this last year, when things got hard, when he was not performing well, They went up tempo. They put the pressure back on the defense, and they were able to get Jared Goff really nice, easy completions.
I was going to say, what was that tweet that Curtis sent us a while back where it was like Jared Goff averaged like 3.8 yards per pass during one of the games, and the Rams went on to win that one, but it was because it was quick little passes. And that gears toward my second question, which was, when we talked about Schottenheimer, you said when Carroll brought him in, his major was the run game. It was exactly what Carroll wants to do. When they didn't have the run game as effectively as they wanted to, and when teams started taking out some of those deep passes, that intermediate pass game was not his major, so it's hard to suddenly flip the script and lean toward that. Is Shane Waldron a guy where, for lack of a better way to phrase this question, that's one of his majors?
It is. It is. And you look at the way that they attacked offensively, they use choice routes. They use choice routes with Cooper Kupp. They use choice routes with their tight ends. They had a bunch of guys that were able to run some of those things that I think DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett can do, and they can find somebody else through free agency that can do some of those things that the Rams offense likes to do. I also think that you look at Luke Getsy and his background, Stacey, as well, with Green Bay. They did an excellent job of moving around Davante Adams. They did an excellent job of using Marquez Valdes-Scantling downfield and using his speed and being able to accentuate Alan Lazard's strengths, being this big physical guy that could run over the middle and be a guy that can catch balls over the middle of the field. They did a great job of identifying who they had, and they took a guy in Tonyan as their tight end who was a nobody, and made him a really good, effective player for their offense. So I believe both of those guys have great background in terms of being a part of schemes and systems and brain trusts and conversations to game plan to utilize guys' strengths to the best of their ability. And the only knock on all three of these candidates, Stacey, that I don't particularly love is that they don't have a strong history of calling plays.
This is something they share.
This is something they all share. They have not been the OCs that are calling plays on Sundays. Luke Getsy had a little bit of an opportunity to call plays at the collegiate level. Shane Waldron had the ability to call plays at the collegiate level, but not at the NFL level. And so that is my one concern. But you're waiting for the other shoe to drop, Stacey. But so far, out of that Shanahan tree, you look at Kyle Shanahan, you look at Sean McVay, you look at Matt LaFleur, any of those guys that have been hired, they didn't necessarily have tremendous background, especially Matt LaFleur. He did not call plays in 2017 for the Los Angeles Rams when Sean McVay first got there. And yet he was hired as the head coach. That hire was highly scrutinized. And yet he's done pretty darn well for himself. So that doesn't mean that those two guys cannot be effective and be good coordinators in this league.
It's almost like people should give Eric Bieniemy a shot with that same criticism. Yeah. It's weird.
Could be.
Last question here. We're going to get to four down territory in a minute. Can we get back to what Mike Salk was talking about just a little bit? I know 2 minutes doesn't seem like quite enough time to talk about it, but that idea that he said of it taking so long and him being worried, what if part of it? And there are many good reasons it would be taking so long, including carrying out an exhaustive search to make sure you get the right fit for your organization. That's a very fair reason to take a while. It could also be that maybe you weren't expecting to part ways with your offensive coordinator, right? Mm-hmm. Both very fair reasons. He said, another reason I'm worried about, quite honestly, is that what if it's not a super desirable place for an offensive coordinator?
You know, the only way that it's not a legitimate desired place is that they don't that a coordinator doesn't feel like they have full reign and full control. I know that there's some narrative that, hey, maybe some coordinators just don't want to work with Russell Wilson. Could be. I don't know many out there that are worth their salt that wouldn't want to work with Russell Wilson, a legit top three talent. But maybe there's some that say they look at their offense and say, he doesn't fit exactly what I would like to do or how I would like my offense to run. But for most coaches in the NFL, what attracts them is the ability to do things their way and to have full control over that. That's why, Stacey, when Sean McVay makes a hire at the defensive coordinator position, it's not to have oversight and to tell that coordinator what to do. It is entrusting that guy that he is just as smart as him and that can do his job that he's more of an expert in to run it to the best of his ability. That's the way that a guy like Sean McVay runs it. And operates. And there are a lot of coaches that do that. You look at Matt LaFleur and Mike Pettine right now, the defensive coordinator in Green Bay, is getting a ton of heat right now. And his seat, I think, is really, really hot and to see what he's doing. But Matt LaFleur allows Mike Pettine, good or bad, to do his job and puts trust in him to do his job. And so I think that that is one aspect, one heavy aspect about if there was any deterrent or a big-time coordinator to come in and take over is that simple fact that Pete Carroll wants to have control and wants to have his hands on both sides of the ball, defense, offense, special teams. He wants to be a part of those conversations. He wants to be a part of the game planning each week. And I think for a lot of guys, that's not necessarily the most appealing aspect of it. That doesn't mean you can't find a good coordinator that can execute your vision and bring something different and dynamic.
All right, three names to watch: Shane Waldron, Luke Getsy, Ken Dorsey. Neither have made a decision on where they are going to land yet. Three remaining names, at least one of which Dorsey has been linked to Seattle. Three that Jake says he wouldn't mind seeing here. Two in particular, Jake, in favor of Shane Waldron, Luke Getsy. Keep an eye on those guys. It's 12:15. That means it's time for Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Mac and Jack's African Amber Ale.
With Jake and Stacy.
We live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down, Jake. With all the COVID shutdowns, athletics in the high school level in the state of Washington have been moved back, but any new developments on what's going on with that?
Any new developments? Yeah. I mean, there's a positive step in the right direction. It was said that from Governor Jay Inslee that high school athletics, particularly high school football, could start practices starting February 1st, and that they could try to play and have a shortened season starting in March. But that, however, is predicated off of whether certain districts and counties are in phase two rather than phase one. So it's still, there's still a lot determined and up in the air, and it's left to every single district to act on their own. So really, this is unprecedented territory, guys. We could have a, theoretically, you could have athletic sports going on at different times throughout the year. You could have high school football, one district, let's say down south in Tacoma, going from March and ending somewhere in April to maybe districts up here in the Seattle area not starting till you know, April and finishing in May. So it's going to be a wide variety and range, and it's all dependent on where each district and county is in terms of the phases. But at least there is a positive step in the right direction that high school football could be possibly played and high school athletics are on track to potentially start competing in sports, which would be an awesome thing for all these kids who have not been able to do the things that they love, you know, during this pandemic.
Second down. Stacy.
Curtis. Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, you know.
Come here often?
Yeah.
Oh, from 11 to 2 every day.
Yep.
Interesting. Kevin King, he had a brutal day on Sunday trying to stop the Buccaneers.
Go Dogs?
Yeah, go Huskies. But he's going to be an unrestricted free agent. So would you want him to be added to the Seahawks secondary?
Look, when Kevin King was drafted, there were many people saying, oh, the Seahawks should have made a move here. This is someone you could have had. And he has made some great plays. And I wouldn't be, like, mad if he ended up with the Seahawks. I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing some additional depth there at cornerback, especially with someone that has starting experience, and most especially if Shaquille Griffin leaves. But please listen to this stat that I pulled from The Ringer. This was Green Bay's cornerback situation this year. Jair Alexander and Kevin King, right? They're two starters. Opposing quarterbacks completed just 50.7% of passes when targeting Alexander and had a 68.3 rating. Here's when targeting King. King allowed 68.6% completion percentage and a 105.8 passer rating. Alexander was Pro Football Focus's second highest graded cornerback in coverage. King was 152. So I would hesitate to say it would be any kind of substantial improvement over what you've already got at corner with the Seattle Seahawks. Now, obviously, I am not opposed to it if it's a cheap option, nor adding depth. But it's, oh man, that was a bad game. Bad game.
Third down. Jake, what stat did you see yesterday that's still blowing your mind about Tom Brady?
Tom Brady, 21 years in the NFL. Everybody just focuses on 20 because that's how many years he has started in the league. But if you look at 21 seasons, he's been to a Super Bowl 10 out of 21. That's 47%. Steph Curry's career three-point percentage is 43%. It is more likely that Tom Brady is going to reach the Super Bowl than Steph Curry is to make a three-point shot.
What?
Are you kidding me?
Steph Curry's the greatest shooter of a basketball ever.
Of all time. And there is a greater percentage that Tom Brady will get to a Super Bowl than Steph Curry will make a three-pointer. Think about that. Absurd
dumb.
Stat.
That makes me mad.
It does. It makes me really mad. That's Rich get richer.
That's stupid. Fourth down.
He's been in 18% of all Super Bowls.
It's insane.
Yeah, think about that. Almost 20% of all Super Bowls played have featured Tom Brady.
It's nuts.
I'm getting frustrated.
I'm getting frustrated. I don't like it. I don't
greater percentage than Steph Curry making a three-pointer.
It's weird how in sports we talk about the GOATs and how fantastic that conversation is. And then when it gets to someone who's like a GOAT who wins all the time, we're like, I'm so tired of that guy. Hate it.
Jake, fourth down. Will there be a hard correction on how NFL teams approach quarterback contracts moving forward?
Yeah, I saw a tweet from Bucky Brooks, at Bucky Brooks, and he put that out there, that he thinks that there is going to be a major market correction for quarterbacks because it is detrimental to your franchise when you overpay a quarterback who's just a guy. And when you look at the NFL right now, you look at Ben Roethlisberger, who might be on his way out the door making $34 million. Jared Goff, I still can't believe the Rams gave him this contract. Jared Goff has a contract of $33.5 million. Kirk Cousins, $33 million. Carson Wentz, $32 million. And they're looking at that contract as an immovable contract that they have to bring back a guy who has been around Frank Reich for two seasons, just to see if he rubbed off that Frank Reich magic that he had for Carson Wentz. I mean, it puts your franchise in a really, really tough position. So when it comes to just average quarterbacks in the league, I don't think that you're going to see NFL teams just ceremoniously hand out big contracts. It is going to have to, you're going to have to be a legitimate franchise quarterback that is a top five quarterback in this league to get some of this big time dollars that guys like Patrick Mahomes, Deshaun Watson, and Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers currently have. I think that NFL teams were going on a really, really difficult trajectory because if you just pay every first round pick that you've ever had or every quarterback that's currently your franchise quarterback up for a new deal in that market rate, you're going to put yourself in a really, really bad bind.
John Forslund has joined the Seattle Kraken as the team's television voice. It's an exciting, exciting hire, and we have a chance to talk to him. He joins us next on Jake and Stacy.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Rost.
Down to the center zone. Anisimov, now Jordan, walking in.
I got yelled at by Curtis. We are going to be joined by John Forslund. He is going to be the new television voice for your Seattle Kraken. That news announced with John joining us after being a longtime Carolina Hurricanes play-by-play announcer. He will become the first television broadcaster in the Kraken's existence, in their history. Joining us right now is John Forslund. John, how are you?
Oh, my God, that's a lot of pressure. Hi, Stacy. How are you?
I'm good. How was your trip here? Did you just land in Seattle recently? Are you here yet?
No, I'm in Connecticut. I have a game with NBC tomorrow night, and so we're doing everything remotely. But I'm going to get there as soon as I can. I can't wait to get out there and take it all in and just jump right in.
Awesome.
I'm very blessed. This is a great opportunity.
Now, John, you've been with the Carolina Hurricanes for a long time. How weird is it going to be to transition to the Seattle Kraken, and how excited are you for this new journey?
Yeah, I was with the Canes since the 1800s. Can you believe that? That's how long it's been.
I have written down 1991. I must have misplaced my notes.
1891.
I joined the Whalers in 91 and got the TV gig in 95 and relocated with the team in 97. And very proud of the 23 years and what we're able to do there and create the Caniac Nation and get the Hurricanes into some sort of relevance. And really, we were blessed with some great teams in 02 and a championship team in 06 and so on. But, and it's a huge but, this opportunity here comes at a great time for me. You just don't get this opportunity as a broadcaster to get another crack at, you know, no pun intended, but an opportunity to get with a team from day number one and start marking all these moments and just connecting with a fan base and growing the brand and being part of this journey. So I'm pumped up for this. I can't wait.
Now, is that what made this move so appealing for you? Were there other factors at play where you thought this just feels right for me right now?
Yeah, exactly, Stacy. It feels absolutely 100% right. I was lucky that I had a couple of options that I could have looked at, I still have my role with NBC, and I welcome that, and Seattle sees that as a positive. So whatever the case is moving forward, my prime focus will be these broadcasts with the Seattle Kraken, and again, to get the opportunity to break ground with this franchise. And then to learn about the franchise, of course I have a connection with Ron Francis that goes way back, but it was handed from Ron to Todd Lewicki, and then to meet and discuss this opportunity with so many different people, I realized this is a great organization. And at this stage of my career, that's what you're looking for. So I'm very proud that they selected me, and I can't wait to start.
John, you talk about the relationship you have with Kraken GM Ron Francis and your time that you guys spent in Carolina and Hartford. How much did that factor into your decision? You kind of talked through the process there real quick, but how excited are you to reunite with him?
Well, when everything broke down in North Carolina, my contract expired on June 30th, which is something I didn't see coming. The first phone call I got on July 1st was from Ron Francis, and it really wasn't about this opportunity. It was about how are you and how's your family and how've you been and all these different things. And that's one point I'd like to reinforce, and I think the fans, maybe some of them already know, but you will find out what a great individual this guy is. So a Hall of Fame player, but a Hall of Fame person. And I think, you know, all of the ingredients that you need to be a hockey management individual, he has. He knew this was probably going to be coming his way at some point, not necessarily the Seattle job, but when he played, I could see it. I knew that he would morph into a manager at some point because the way he looks at the game, the way he methodically lays out a plan, it's all going to fall into place. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. But then when you get to the fact that personally I can reconnect with him and work with him again, of course, it's a number one plus on the pro side of the ledger.
Now, John, your love of hockey clearly precedes your career as a broadcaster, the voice of a team. But there's going to be a lot of new hockey fans here in Seattle, people that haven't really been that attached to the NHL that are now going to learn to fall in love with it. What's been your experience with fans who are kind of new to the game and how they grow to love it?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to establish a first-rate broadcast, and I'm going to try and develop a trust with the fan base. That's my number one goal. And I think the game will sell itself. Hockey, to me, is the greatest sport in the world, and it's absolutely exhilarating to see in person. But then you have to follow it on radio and television. And it's been my experience in all of our years, in North Carolina, growing it. You're always going to have people who are aware of the game. They've seen it before. They're fans of it. They're people who follow other teams and maybe now will become fans of the Kraken. But then there's brand new people. And the brand new people are the ones that I really enjoy connecting with the most. They're the ones that jump in with both feet and just, you know, can't get enough of it and immerse themselves in it. And that's what's going to happen here. And, as soon as, opening night and we move on with the first season, wait till the first playoff game, wait till the second round, wait till the third round. And if the team wins the Stanley Cup, I believe they will at some point, it's going to be an unbelievable moment. And I know it's an unbelievable sports landscape there. And I have experience in trying to find, a place for the National Hockey League, which was hard at the beginning in North Carolina, as you can imagine, with their rich history in college basketball and college football. But the Kraken will find their spot in the Seattle sports landscape, and everyone will be proud of this organization.
John, you got me fired up right now, man. I tell you what, I am ready to go. I'm ready for some hockey to be here in Seattle and to be listening to you call the games on TV here in Seattle. We are fired up about it. John, I have to ask you, you kind of laid it out, your idea from your experience of starting scratch with a new market, a new fan base. What was that process like for you? And then to be able to do it again, how exhilarating is it to have that opportunity? You said it earlier, so rare.
Yeah, it's really rare, and it's energizing. So to be a play-by-play guy in the NHL, there will be now 32 jobs, right? So it's not easy to get. And when you do get connected with a team, it's a privilege. But, you know, no matter where you're at, whether you're in Toronto or Boston or Chicago or Detroit, and in my case in Raleigh, which was quite different than the places I just mentioned, when you get to an expansion situation like we saw a couple of years ago in Vegas, there's just something about it because we're all growing together at the same time. So, yes, it's going to be something that I will never take for granted. But I can tell you that what was great to be part of in North Carolina was, you know, starting from the beginning and taking our telecast to where they were when I left. And when I left, the Athletic publication, the website, selected us, or the fans did, in and out of market, the number one local broadcast. So if I can do my part and add to that and hopefully get the gold standard where it needs to be with the Seattle Kraken, that's the first goal. The rest of it's easy, because the game takes care of itself, and the players will provide all the excitement. There's nothing like it. There's absolutely nothing like it. Every game night is special. We're all going to share in this. And, again, the anticipation is getting the best of me right now. I can't wait.
That's awesome to hear. Hey, last question here. Where'd your hey, what do you say phrase come from?
Okay, so that one there is a direct link to my dad. So long story short, when I started having these ideas that I wanted to do this when I was about 10 years old, I did all the games into a cassette recorder off the television, Boston Bruin games in Massachusetts. My dad was my color man. And when I got my first gig at the age of 22 in the American Hockey League, the first paycheck I ever received from a team, I came home, and unfortunately, my dad passed away the next morning. He was my best friend, and he used to say that phrase all the time. So a couple of years later, riding buses in the AHL, I decided to use it on a broadcast to honor him. And then I decided I'm going to use it when I think the game's a lock. So it's easy in overtime. It's easy late in the third period, but I will use that phrase in the second period if I think the game's over, in this case on the Kraken side of things. So it's just a tribute to my dad. And some people early in my career took shots at it. I'm never going to lose sight of that. And anyway, that's a personal thing for me.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
That's awesome.
That's really awesome. All right. You're welcome. Seattle Kraken television play-by-play announcer John Forslund. You guys, welcome him to Seattle. You can follow him and should be following him at John Forslund. He's also, as a reminder, like John just told us, he's going to be on the call tomorrow for the Blackhawks-Predators game. So, like Curtis Rogers said, appointment viewing for you Seattle Kraken fans. Thanks so much, John.
I won't make too many mistakes, okay?
We can't wait. We can't wait. Right? Have a good call.
Yeah. Look forward to meeting you all. Take care.
Bye. All right. Coming up, LeBron James was inspired by some trash talk he received the other day. That's next in the timeline.
This is the timeline
with Jake and Stacy,
brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by the Pro Club. Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross here for the timeline, reading you guys the top stories you're going to see on your own Twitter timelines. When you see any you want us to include, please do tag us at JTHeaps9, at Stacy Ross. Getting started with LeBron James. His 21-point fourth quarter performance on Monday was inspired by trash talk he received from a Cavs front office member during the game. Cut number four, here he is explaining that.
There's someone I know for sure. Felt like he was just a little bit too excited about seeing me miss. That's what happened.
Anything else on that, or he knows who he is?
Or? Yeah, I know who he is. You know, he's part of the front office group. He was really excited about me missing, that shot a little bit more extra than I would have liked. But he got a roof for his team, obviously, and he was he showcased that. So I knew I had another quarter, and the fourth quarter is my favorite.
Things I don't want to do: trash talk any elite athlete ever, never well, ever.
Just why? Why,
don't do it.
Why would
don't
you?
Don't do it. The best athletes are also the best grudge holders. Like, no
yes.
one excels at holding a grudge and having your words stick to them the way professional athletes do. It is an uncommon skill. In addition to being able to jump high, throw far, do everything that most people cannot do, can also hang on to a grudge.
Correct. And when,
like, nobody's business.
Well, but also given the history there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, front office member with Cleveland, obviously giving LeBron the business because he's mad about LeBron leaving and going somewhere else. And in that moment, I mean, LeBron just goes on and drops 46 on you. So you talk about grudges and you talk about getting guys extra motivated on a given night. I mean, LeBron, I'll just put it this way. You know, 17 points the last game, 34 points the game after that, 19-21. You clearly sparked him to drop 46 on you. So I hope the trash talk was worth it in the moment. I hope you got him good.
It's just upsetting knowing that someone could trash talk me and I'm never going to be that good. You know?
Like, there's nothing you can do about it.
It's defeating knowing someone could be like, yeah, Stacey, you'll never, I don't know, jump high, just anything like that. And I'd be like, yeah, you're right.
Like when you try to throw your trash in the trash can
every day. I've made it in there before. You're much closer to it than I am.
No.
Moving on.
No.
Hashtag.
There's not a whole lot you can do about
thank
that.
You, Aaron, is trending on Twitter. If you're wondering why, that's in part because Aaron Rodgers hinted at an uncertain future in his postgame comments after the NFC Championship loss to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He has since then appeared on the Pat McAfee Show to clarify some of his comments. This is what Aaron said. Quote, at least one of the things. I don't think I said anything I haven't said before. Ultimately, my future, and he says my future is, I just lost it. My future is not in my control. I was thinking about Aaron Jones and Corey Linsley. Both are scheduled free agents. I don't see a reason why I shouldn't be back, which is a little interesting because one of the things he said was, quote, future's up in the air, including my own. And so people then took it as one of two things. Aaron Rodgers being emotional and uncertain of what would be happening to him, knowing that the team just months before had drafted his replacement. Or two, Aaron Rodgers using some leverage to tell the front office, I am willing to end my career elsewhere if you don't make the right moves. Either can be true, but Aaron clarifying in his interview today that he doesn't see a reason he shouldn't be back.
Yeah, and he wanted to clarify for everybody out there on the Pat McAfee Show that, you know, the media was just running wild and rampant with what he said, but he was very clear about what the implications would lead to with what he said post-game. So amazing sometimes when athletes don't recognize the weight of their words or how they said it. Here's what Aaron Rodgers said.
I don't feel like I said anything that I hadn't said before. You know, I said it the first time I talked to the media. It was more a realization, I think, that my future is not necessarily in my control. And I think that was what just kind of hit me in the moment. I was thinking about, you know, Aaron Jones and Corey Linsley. And I don't think that there's any reason why I wouldn't be back. But look, I think there's not many absolutes, as you guys know, in this business.
Yeah, there's not many absolutes, but that's not the way that you talked about it post-game. You didn't say, I expect to be back. You said, I don't know if I will be. I don't know. There's a lot of people's futures that are up in the air, and you led to it as you were sulking up there, and you were talking about how it wasn't your call to not go for it on fourth down there with Matt LaFleur. I mean, it's very easy to see how you could walk people down that road. It's not a great mystery. So to come on the Pat McAfee Show and say, well, I don't understand it. I didn't say anything that I haven't said before. It was in the context and the way that you went about saying it. But this was also the point that I said from the very beginning this week that Aaron Rodgers isn't going anywhere. The Green Bay Packers aren't dealing Aaron Rodgers anywhere. He will be a Green Bay Packer over the next couple seasons. Jordan Love is not ready for that transition yet. And the Green Bay Packers have history with this. You know, Aaron Rodgers didn't get his first start and his first opportunity to be a full-time starter till year four of his career.
Saying that there's no certainty in this business is true. The NFL is a very cutthroat business, but Aaron Rodgers also knows that the Green Bay Packers are going to take a huge financial hit if they were to trade or release or anything when it comes to his contract, because he carries at least this year for 2021 something like $31.5 million in dead cap. He knows what his contract situation is. So when he says, oh, I mean, I don't know, you know how this business is, the Green Bay Packers aren't cutting him. They aren't getting rid of him. He is saying that knowing that either fans will interpret it as him feeling underappreciated or that the Packers front office will hear the message that he wants a little bit more done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Aaron also is one of those guys that, you know, is the master in terms of, you know, kind of digging the knife in a little bit in terms of pointing the blame somewhere else. And, you know, right now everybody's looking at Matt LaFleur. They're looking at Mike Pettine. They're not looking at Aaron Rodgers. And I think that Aaron is extremely comfortable being in that spot and not shying away from that blame going towards them, only kind of shifting it a little bit more that way. And so I think for him in his career at this point in time, look, I'm not saying there should be a ton of blame that's put on Aaron Rodgers. He had an amazing year. He had a great career. He's had a great career up to this point. And also in that Tampa game, he played really, really well. He didn't capitalize on the three. He didn't capitalize on two of the interceptions that Tom Brady had in the second half there that I think you could point to. But overall, I mean, Aaron Rodgers was a big reason why you were in that game at all. So it really comes down to Green Bay, all the decisions being put on them. And I think Aaron, it just cracks me up after the fact, Aaron Rodgers sitting there going, well, I don't know how these rumors are getting circling. Everybody's just being crazy.
It's
in
like
the
guy in the hot dog advert. We're all trying to figure out who did this.
Just like, you started this. You know exactly what you did.
Speaking of digging the knife, from the 816, yeah, Stacey, you'll never make a solid pun while on air.
Whoa.
That cuts to Stacey's core.
Well, looks like Rodgers is airing out some of his grievances.
All right.
That's not bad. You can
insult me about puns, and then I don't make it better.
The delivery wasn't strong. That's the problem.
I can be
the
better.
The pun itself actually wasn't bad. It was the delivery.
Yeah. I guess you can say... Well, Justin Dunn joins us next.
Nice.
There we go.
I am sorry. All right. We are going to speak with Justin Dunn, talking a little Mariners. We'll dig into some NFL headlines after that. Plenty of good stuff coming up. That all starts in the 1 o'clock hour on Jake and Stacey.